This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everybody. This is Basma Farhat from the People Speak radio show, where we believe the people speak and make a difference. Tonight, the people speak with Mark Watts. Mark is the eldest son of Alan Watts, philosopher, writer, speaker, and expert in comparative religion, Roshi, musician, lecturer, entertainer, just an amazing, amazing man. Hello, Mark. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Mark, you know, we've heard, obviously I know Alan Watts, and I know a lot of our audience members are great fans of Alan. As a matter of fact, I've had to call some people to make sure they didn't miss this show because they were so excited about it. You currently run the archived Alan Watts Mountain Center. Exactly what is the Mountain Center, and how does it help to protect and nurture the writings and the teachings of your father?
Well, the Alan Watts Mountain Center is something that's in the process of coming into being. The entity that has preserved and distributed the programs to public radio for since 1975 is Electronic University, which was conceived with my father in 1972. And so over the years, we've been the small publishing company that has kept the talks in circulation and, you know, just done wonderful things. And, you know, we've had just so many people come and to us with great ideas, great projects, and the result is really to grow a community around these ideas, but also around the introduction of these ideas to other generations, other cultures. It's sort of a fascinating prospect to see where we're going in terms of new media, you know, foreign translations, and all of that over the years. But the Mountain Center actually came about more recently as a desire to have a permanent home, but more importantly, a place where people could come together to work on these projects. We've operated primarily from private studios and offices and homes, and the idea of the Mountain Center was that we could bring people together for extended periods, a day or two, a week or two, and do everything from create websites to have conferences to meet and make new recordings. And so the place where that's occurring is on a mountaintop in West Marin, and I say it's in the process of becoming because literally it's in construction. And it's been in construction for 2 years, and people can see photos of it online at thealanwatts.com website. If you go to the bottom of the page, there are links to the Mountain Center. And it's a remarkable place, both because it's out in the wilds of West Marin and surrounded by National Park, but also because we're working with the designs of Daniel Lieberman, who's an organic architect, and working on creating buildings that really embody the spirit of the work that is to be done there.
Well, which is fascinating because if I'm not mistaken, your father was very into the green evolution or revolution and was very concerned as far as the environment was went. Is that true?
Yeah, he was at, he attended what he called a planetary alarm conference in 1971 with Margaret Mead and John Lilly and a lot of other people, and was, I guess you would describe him now as an early pioneer in ecological awareness. He used to say that he'd usually give talks about mystical experience, but when the audience was more scientific or more professional, he would often just simply substitute the words ecological awareness and then go ahead and give the same talk.
That's fascinating because I think from my understanding of everything that I'd ever read or heard of your father's, you're right. He absolutely was very flexible and fluid when it came to his audience, and he just kind of switched it off, but, you know, which is amazing that he was able to do that.
Yeah, I think that part of it was that he liked to make a connection without using what he called spookery, which was, loosely speaking, invoking a lot of concepts or words or ideas that people didn't really understand. So he was always looking for common ground with respect to how you translate an idea. You saw this again and again when he's trying to translate words like sabi wabi and yugen and some of these aesthetic terms, and looking for just the right way of doing it.
Let me ask you, Mark. I mean, let's face it, your father is really considered to be one of the most prolific and profound philosophers of the century. How was it growing up with a man of that caliber, an icon in mysticism?
Well, it was really wonderful. My parents were divorced, so I actually didn't get to hang out with my father much. Went between 11 and 14, and around 14 I read the book, and that really woke me up to what he was doing. And by 16 I was recording him, and he passed away when I was only 22. But those years from 16 to 22, we got to hang out a lot, and many road trips of speaking tours and trips to Big Sur, and we did a lot of things together, including work on his last book, Tao the Watercourse Way. And I can only describe it as an incredibly wonderful, eye-opening experience. And we had a lot in common in our interest in visual language, and he was practicing Chinese calligraphy at the time, and I found that fascinating. And actually have gone on to do a lot of research on calligraphic and visual languages.
Now, with the Watercourse Way, he actually passed away during the writing of that book, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
Did
he was about two-thirds of the way
there. He never actually completed it. How are you handling that particular project, since it was not a complete work?
Well, we actually, I had a pretty good idea from his audio what would come next. So we went ahead and put out a book called Taoism, Way Beyond Seeking, that in theory wraps it up. Because what he'd done is he'd introduced it, then he went through all of the major concepts in Taoism, and it was really lacking a conclusion. So we put together a short book, and I think it's still pretty available, Way Beyond Seeking.
One of the greatest books that impacted me during my path and during my growth process of your father's, and he was an icon of mine. I truly admired his philosophies. The book This Is It, wasn't that an essay, not necessarily a book?
It became a book, but it's one chapter in the book. This Is It, and one of the most succinct and powerful things I think he ever wrote. And
talk to us about This Is It.
Well, I think that when you try and approach these subjects from within any social context where people have been indoctrinated by various religions, it's a little bit hard to get outside of the box. And for instance, Joseph Campbell would use a technique of the four functions of mythology, and he would always say that the first function is the mystical function, which established the fact that the dialogue was mystical. And in This Is It, what my father really did was introduce a little bit of the history of mystical experience and how it's impacted religion. But what he did that was really interesting was he portrayed it in a way that was extremely accessible to everybody. And I think that is really the power of his teachings overall, is that he's not talking about something esoteric or inaccessible or something for a privileged few. He's talking about something that's really part of our common sense reality, and he goes right to those blocks, those logical contradictions in our existence where we become derailed. And I love it when he talks about Buddha as the world's first great psychologist, in that he was very aware of the traps that human beings get into with the reflective self. One of my favorite quotes is, the trouble with the small self is that it thinks it's the large self. And so one of the parts of every talk that my father gave would be a little bit on the confusion of who we think we are and who we actually are. And this was his sort of standard groundbreaking mechanism for beginning the dialogue.
you know, do you think that your father, Alan Watts, actually had reconciled his issues with the fact that he was an Anglican priest and also a Zen Roshi?
Yes, I do. I think that even earlier in his career, when he went back to the church and he tried to explore the mystical side of Christian theology, and of course ran into great resistance in the church, even at that point in the 40s, he had a basic idea of where it all came together philosophically. Now, that's very different from culturally. And I think that you can hear, though, over the years, a shift in the tone of his works. Where he, in his early works, he was attempting to be more scholarly, and you could almost hear him addressing the church fathers and some of the theologians that he debated with in the early years. And that's particularly true in Behold the Spirit and the Beyond Theology and even the meaning of happiness. In those earlier works, you can hear this in his voice. But then there's a certain point at which he lets that go, and he realizes this is really about the greater audience. It isn't about the intellectual discussion or the theological discussion. And I think that there's certain talks that he gave that we put together in the Myth and Religion series that where he really compared and contrasted Eastern and Western religions. And I think these are some of his most interesting talks. They're very dynamic, and you know, there's one that he gave in New York City where he talks about if Jesus came back today, would he be welcomed as the Messiah, or would he end up in a mental institution? And of course, he's giving this before a group of psychiatrists, and he talks about how that is handled in the social context. And the answer, of course, was that he would end up in a mental institution.
Absolutely. Especially with the psychiatry of today in the way it's going. Either that or be on Prozac, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, well, probably.
At the very least.
But actually, today he'd probably end up wandering the streets.
A true ascetic.
I think I think that there's just a common thread in the life of a mystic, that, and it really doesn't matter whether it's an Islamic mystic or a Christian mystic or a Buddhist mystic. I think that they're all basically tapping into the same root energy, and the results are, I mean, the tree that grows from that is very similar. And as much as it's going to be embedded different in every culture in which it occurs, because of, you know, we have completely different language concepts, you know, expectations, I think that there is a common experience there that made it for him pretty easy to see the comparatively, to look at religions comparatively and see the associations.
Well, you know, it's been a long time since I've read the book, and when I was doing the research on the interview with you today, I ran across this on your site, and it reminded me, this was one of my favorite models and quotes, and in his book, in Alan Watts' own words, he said, "This book explores an unrecognized but mighty taboo, our tactic conspiracy to ignore who or what we really are. Briefly, the prevalent sensation of oneself as a separate ego enclosed in a bag of skin is a hallucination which accords neither with Western science nor with the experimental philosophy religions of the East." I just think, you know, when you talk about that bag of skin is a hallucination, you know, that image was just so profound at the time for me. And it's true. It is a taboo. Why is it still taboo? And is it getting, do you believe that the words of your father are now being explored from a different position?
Yes, I do. I mean, in his time, he was really considered a radical. And today, his ideas are much more assimilable, I think, because people have been exposed to more. And also, I think that we're just coming to a time culturally due to communications media and, cultural interaction, what's happening in the music world. All of these things are coming together, and we're becoming aware that boundaries between people are artificial boundaries. And so I think we're much more willing to look at what separates us and what the nature of that really is, and much better equipped to do that than we were in his time. And yes, I think it's I mean, the next step of human evolution, I think, is from many to the one. And if we're going to make that jump and realize that we're not going to get anywhere by walking up and trotting over people, we're going to have to do that through some sort of an inner psychological acceptance of our true nature, which reveals our unity. And at the point that people start to have a working relationship with that, then all of it becomes possible. And at the point it's still a theoretical or, you know, a dismissive attitude toward these kind of experiences, I don't think we're going to move forward very quickly.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, one of my favorite photos of your father's was one that reminds me of the actor Rex Harrison, the English actor, in the movie Professor, when it played Professor Higgins in the movie, oh gosh, what is that with that famous, lovely actress? But anyway, it was a strange metaphor because Professor Higgins wanted to recreate a human being out of something, and your father wanted to recreate our view of what humans are.
Yeah.
And I think that metaphor is just as amazing. Do you think he was able to accomplish that, or he was? Do you think he was satisfied with that kind of with what he did accomplish, which was phenomenal? I mean, his writing, his essays, they just go on and on and on.
I detect so, because there's a certain point in his work where he becomes playful, and you know, he says that, you know, ultimately, what is the meaning of the soul? It's divine lolling, it's nonsense, and he didn't mean it in the sense of it not being worthwhile. It's just not serious, and I think in that expression that he really sort of made it from the scholarly perspective into the, you know, let's call it the musical perspective, and his work approached sort of jazz-like comprehension of what it was that he was playing with. And I love his later seminars. I've been remastering some of them. That it was interesting because when we were working with the tapes, he said, "Yeah, don't worry about those later seminars. They're mostly repetition of what I said before." So for years I didn't pay much attention to them. And then I started archiving them, and I realized, yes, they were very similar, but that he had taken the communication to one further level of playfulness and simplicity. And so now we're releasing them all. Ecological Awareness was one of them, and Future of Communication, some of these later talks. And you see that recurrent thread in it where, you know, he sort of takes you around the block, and then he says, you know, now go play in the park.
You know, that must have been very endearing for you, Mark. You know, being the son of this man.
It's just good fun. I mean, it's like having a passport to all of the best things in the world. You know, you can go anywhere and run into people who've been exposed to his work, and they're all tend to be very interesting. And you know, well directed people. And so it's been fascinating. We've had all kinds of personalities and just unknowns and artists and just really a never-ending flood of very, very interesting people come our way. You know, the South Park guys called us one time and said, "Geez, you know, we do this late-night show you probably never heard of, and we'd love to animate some of your dad's work." So they created a couple of animations, and we've had a lot of musicians ask us for pieces to sample. So it's sort of a never-ending creative montage. And, you know, I do what I can to facilitate every sincere project that comes our way.
You know, Gary Zukav had once made a statement, and he said that one reaches the place of knowing. Your father obviously had reached out over his traditional education. Do you think that he reached, and one of his statements, he had said, "When you've got the message, hang up the phone." Do you think at that point that he had reached that place of knowing?
Well, I think that first of all, that quote, "When you get the message, hang up the phone," that was actually a reference to taking LSD. And it was his cautionary word of advice to the truth seekers who were, you know, experimenting with mescaline, LSD, mushrooms. And, you know, basically what he was saying was, you know, once you get that insight, you can, you know, regardless of where it comes from, you can then, you know, hone in on it without that catalyst. And so I think that particular phase of his life where he experimented with psychedelics and was introduced to Indian music, and this would be the late 60s, 67 through 69, was very, very important in for him personally to be able to cut loose of this need that I think he felt to in some way justify his career. And I think that you know, goes back to, you know, critics that he had, both from the church and later from the stricter Zen community, that, you know, he didn't really practice traditional practice, and he didn't meditate enough, or, you know, whatever the various, you know, comments were. But, yeah, I really do. I think you can just hear it in his voice, and some of the talks just become so playful is all I can, the only way I can describe it. Yeah.
I think whenever you go into that aspect of when you go past that level of the written word and you start to get into the place of knowing, that you almost naturally become playful because it becomes a joyous experience at that point.
It's like watching a virtuoso musician in an improvisation. Everything just sort of comes up and they go with it, and it's a remarkable thing to watch. It's an even more remarkable thing to experience. And, you know, the great jazz sax, or, you know, these some of the Indian musicians that he admired so much, Ravi Shankar and Alaraka, you know, these guys were just amazing. And I think that really, you know, fed his soul. I think it really helped him come to full circle, fruition in a full circle with this thing that he was looking into.
Did you ever meet any of your father's cohorts in Zenism, such as Joseph Campbell or Suzuki, D.T. Suzuki, who, I, if I'm not mistaken, your father really greatly admired?
Yeah. Suzuki came to the Buddhist Lodge when my father was 15 or 16 years old and profoundly influenced him. I know that he was a little older than that. But he was not only his writings, but listening to him speak and you know, hanging out with him. Joseph Campbell was sort of a different kind of character in that he was a later influence. I think they met in 1950, but a very profound one. And I actually also produce and edit the works of Joseph Campbell in audio. So it's been interesting because from far after it happened, I can look back and see the dialogue that they had reflected in their talks. My dad gave a talk called Sheet Black, where he talked about the astronaut who went far out into space and was asked upon his return if he'd seen God, and he said yes, and she is black. And Joe was at that lecture. I was there recording, and Joe and Gene were there. And 12 years later, he published. It was actually a collection of writings leading up to it, The Inner Reaches of Outer Space. But I could see the impact of that evening. And it was very funny because I later spoke with Jean about it, and she said, after 40 minutes into the talk, Joe turned to her and said, "That's it. He hasn't looked at a note yet. I'm throwing out my notes." And I said, "Well, okay, Jean, I know the date of that talk. I was there. I'm going to listen to Joe's talks before and after and see if Alan did him a service or a disservice." But yeah, they talked a lot over the years, and I know that in 1950 they had a meeting at John Cage's house in New York, and over dinner discussed the Vikings of the Pacific, and you know, the diffusion of knowledge and mythic themes, and then they went into the library to talk further, and my mom listened to John Cage play Prepared Piano. But I heard about this as a kid, so I was just incredibly interested in, you know, who are these Vikings of the Pacific? So I read everything I could get my hands on about navigation until I figured out that these were Polynesian canoe sailors who knew how to navigate by the stars and probably carried mythic images back and forth from the Pacific to South America. But it was really interesting because years and years later, Joe came to the ferry boat where I was living and gave a talk there. And I was hoping to hear what where that conversation had gone in 20 years. But it was very funny when they got together to talk. All they talked about was women and they had various experiences they'd had in their later years. And Alan's not being altogether positive, but yeah, it was a fascinating conversation in its own right. But I never got to hear where they left off on diffusionism.
Did you really know who these people were at the time in your youth, or the caliber of these people?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty apparent certainly by the late '60s. My father had been adopted as a counterculture hero, and Joe was starting to get a following, and I was more disposed for his work just personally because many of the themes interested me. Other people like John Lilly, and Gary Snyder and Al Wong, these people would come to the boat and also give seminars, and many of them I didn't really associate as much with them as I did with Alan and Joe's work.
Well, I think that's just amazing. I can't even imagine, like I said, growing up with the likes of Alan Watts in your life, Suzuki, as a mentor for him, Joseph Campbell, coming to the boat, to the houseboat. What a collection of stories you have. Are you doing any writing?
Well, actually, I am. I'm working on a film script right now. It's my return to California, and actually, I've been meeting with my dad on the East Coast and recording him. But when I turned 18, I moved back to California. So the story begins there, and then goes back to the '60s. And part of it is based on my experience, and part of it's based on the audio archives. And then we'll come back to a conclusion after I was back in California for some time. And so I'm writing about that part of it, and it's a script that we're working on for a film called Inseparable Differences: The Mind of Alan Watts. And
interesting.
But my wife was saying, well, when you get done with that one, you've got to write The Mind of Mark Watts. So we'll see.
Very interesting. Well, listen, we're going to have to take a break right now, folks. For those of you that would like to speak to Mark Watts, son of Alan Watts, the famous or infamous philosopher, but just an amazing, amazing human being, you can call us at 888-861-3519. Again, 888-861-3519. That's toll-free, and we will be back in just a moment. Thank you very much.
And web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hi, this is Randy Rhodes. You know, when Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held serious bipartisan investigations that did result in articles of impeachment. He resigned before he could be impeached, but strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war, lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court orders, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge, tortured, used illegal weapons, and targeted civilians. Ask your Congress member to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Join host Basima Farhat on The People Speak as she interviews guests from the realms of politics, activism, spirituality, science, and entertainment. That's Tuesdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on The People Speak, an audience interactive program where your voice counts.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for being with us this evening. We are speaking with Mark Watts, son of Alan Watts, famous philosophers and Roshi, editor, calligrapher. I mean, I could go on and on. Your father's life is just truly amazing, Mark. And I'm sure you sound like an extremely proud son, and that's very endearing, I think, for a lot of our guests.
It's a remarkable legacy, and it's just a pleasure to be part of it.
Well, I'm sure your father was very proud of you, too. We have a caller, Steve from Santa Fe. Steve, if you'll please state your question for Mark Watts.
Well, it's not really a question, Basima. It's a profound pleasure of mine to tell Alan Watts' son how much his father positively impacted my life. You know, your father did me such a service, and for me to be able to, I mean, because of your father, I ended up being able to study under Joseph Campbell and meeting him, and I never got to meet your father. I mean, every time I'd put in for one of his classes or something, it didn't come through, but your father so positively impacted my life that I still talk about him and think about him, and tremendous. Your father was a very tremendous man, and I think he touched a whole lot of people, including me. I mean, immensely so.
Well, on his behalf, you're welcome.
With that, I'll turn it back over. Thank you.
As you can imagine, I talk to a lot of people who say some things very similar to that, and then I usually have the chance to take the next step and ask them a little bit about themselves, and like this gentleman, they turn out to be remarkable people. They've done a lot with their lives and taken this information and put it to great use.
Did you argue with your father a lot?
Argue?
Yes.
No. He was an incredibly just person, and so he had a way, even though there are seven kids, of just sort of seeing through and recognizing differences and the difference between a dissimilarity and disequality. This is remarkable in that respect.
You know, that's amazing. I can imagine that just from his writings. You imagine this very metered, very, as you said, just human being. And I think that translates in a lot of his writings and a lot of his books. One thing that was actually said about your father was that he wasn't really, some people, you know, had some, I don't know that they were really negative comments, but there was one comment that stated that he was not really a scholar of Eastern philosophy, that they didn't consider Alan Watts to be that disciplined, but that he taught Alan Watts.
Yep.
Mark, what is Alan Wattism?
Well, as he would say, he didn't think it was intellectually respectable to be partisan in matters of religion. And I think that for people who are following a particular path, that's a little hard to take. They want somebody to commit and to be in a box. The closest I think he ever came to that was, I think he made a comment in Tao, the Watercourse Way, when he said, "We Zenists," a sort of a general term for people who appreciate Zen aspects of life. But it was interesting because the thing about discipline, you know, well, you don't sit and meditate for, you know, you're done in 5 or 10 minutes. And he said, you know, a cat sits till it's done sitting, and then it stretches and gets up and walks away. Yeah. So that didn't work with him. I think that what really distinguishes him is that he followed his curiosity. And you can see this in his audio archive, in his writings, in his library, the books that he collected, is that he was always engaged in sort of the next step in his own growth and exploration and discovery of the world, and fascinated with so many authors, G. Spencer Brown, Joseph Campbell, John Lilly, you know, all of these people were, you know, people that he read and just found really interesting information that furthered the dialogue. And so if there's anything that would characterize his works, I would describe it as a dialogue, very much in the Sanzen instead of the Zazen tradition. The Sanzen is the discussion that takes place between the teacher and the master, and we know it as the, you know, koans, go on method of teaching. But I think that that dialogue also takes place within anybody who has a sincere curiosity about the world. Because if you're, you know, clear-headed and you are open to where your mind is taking you and the next steps come your way, that becomes the nature of the dialogue with life, is that your questions will be will open doors and expose you to different things.
Well, it's amazing. We do have another caller, Mike from California. And for those of you, please, Mike, ask your question.
Hello, Mark. My
yes.
question is, I once read a book called Zen and the Art of Archery, and I've always listened to a lot of Alan Watts lectures and read his books. Did your father ever really take one of those Zen bows and actually shoot an arrow up into the air and have it fall down at his feet? I've read things like that about him that he was into Zen archery.
Yeah, Eugene Herigold's book. Actually, we shot a videotape of him in a program called Work as Play, and he begins the program by shooting an arrow into the air. Now, it didn't fall right at his feet. It probably fell over in the muck of the tidal lands there in Sausalito, about 50 or 60 feet away. But he when I was a kid, he loved archery, and he would pull out the bow and arrow and set up hay bales, and we would practice archery on the front lawn. And he appreciated, I think, a lot of the Zen arts. He had the Zen swords that he would swish around in the air, and of course he later did the same thing with calligraphic brushes after Al Wong introduced him to calligraphy. But he was fascinated with the material arts. One of the fun things about the film that we're doing is all of the special effects are going to be real effects that he did. For instance, the rubbing of paper over the grain in wood with ink blotter, which he picked up from Sabra Hasegawa, the famous Japanese artist. And he was a very hands-on person in terms of this type of experimentation, particularly with the technologies of the Far East.
Mark, you said he was very much into martial arts. What particular form of the martial arts did he practice? And what did he think about people like Bruce Lee and the martial arts that was starting to become popular at that time?
In early on, he did a demonstration of judo that is actually on film that he did for the Eastern Wisdom and Modern Life series. But it was interesting, the principles that he was drawn to about it also apply very much equally to Aikido. This idea of taking your opponent's force and direction and just redirecting it a little bit and using it to bring about their downfall. And use, typically they're too much force. I know that that was a fascination of his, but he talked mostly in terms of judo and then later Aikido. I know also, though, it's interesting, side story, that Bruce Lee took the same programs, the Eastern Wisdom programs, and when he was up in Seattle, and showed them to his Western students as a way of teaching them about Zen, about, the flowing, following the Tao and being in the flow. And years later, John Little, Bruce Lee biographer, came and we talked about this, and we actually did some work together based on the materials that Bruce Lee had put together for his courses during his life based on my father's teachings.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike, very much for calling in.
Thanks, Mike.
One of the things that I found very, very fascinating and amazing about your father is, like all spiritualists and all mystics, the necessity for thoughts of peace, tolerance, and understanding among the cultures of the world. Mark, in light of the multi-wars that are currently evolving in our society, what do you think your father would have thought about this present situation?
Probably not much difference than what he thought of Vietnam, which, it's just not a good way to solve problems. And, as we see, violence begets violence and creates more problems. And, it's just an old model, and hopefully we'll outgrow it someday.
you know, that's kind of interesting in a way, getting back to some of the questions that our last caller spoke of. This path of resistance that a lot of the Japanese and ancient arts, as far as defense, you know, how does a spiritualist that is a believer in tolerance and peace and amongst society reconcile the defensive actions of any form of martial art? Have you ever talked to him about any of that?
Yeah, well, we had a very hands-on demonstration one evening with a drunk kept coming to the ferry boat door and pounding on the door. I want to talk to Alan Watts, and I want to be enlightened, and blah, blah, blah. And he asked him to leave politely a couple of times, and the third time he opened the door and pulled the his sword out of the umbrella stand there, unsheathed it, and lifted it over his head, and the fellow said, I thought you were a pacifist. And he says, whatever gave you that mistaken idea? And the guy left pretty quickly.
That is a wonderful story. I love this, imagining him pulling the sword out of the umbrella.
Oh, it was very convincing. I was there. The guy was certain that he was about to be decapitated because he, you know, had that. He knew how to handle the sword, so he came out. And it was very funny.
I think this is
part of cosmic consciousness. It's the ability to see across great levels of magnification. And sort of get out of your own limited perspective. I've had a running discussion with a woman about vegetarianism, and she's an alarmist in that she thinks we should all spring into action and make sure that nobody ever kills another cow. And it was ironic because we had this conversation. I was driving back from Los Angeles, and I saw a huge corral of cows herded for the slaughter in the late afternoon sunlight, and they're standing on one particular hill was a beautiful tan Brahma bull. You know, the last rays of sun shining on it. It was just this amazing image. And then it was ironic because I want to see it better, so I hit the windshield washer to get all the bugs off the windshield because I probably killed 10,000 bugs from L.A. to that point in my journey, and they were all stuck to the windshield. And so it was interesting in the weeks that followed, you know, we had this little ongoing conversation about, I'm so concerned about the bull, and yet I'm, you know, washing the bugs off of my windshield, and that the early Buddhists had filtered their drinking water, and actually some of the Jain, I think, Buddhists practiced taking fewer steps so they wouldn't crush bugs. And so I think it's a level of, you know, what magnification you're looking at things on, but I think that ultimately you have to recognize that life feeds on life. And so at a certain point, your own self-defense is no more inappropriate than it is to do any other number of life-taking activities that you might do in the course of your days to sustain yourself.
I know for myself, having a serious, at one time, almost phobic fear of spiders, had made a deal with all of the spiders in my world. I said, as long as you are outside, you will be safe. And as soon as you enter my home, you're mine.
we have the same arrangement around here.
Exactly. So, yeah, you know, I mean, I had to come to terms with my, and I've often thought of the Buddhists that, as you said, took smaller steps so that they wouldn't crush these bugs. And I thought to myself, well, that would have been okay as long as they were outside.
Let
me ask something, Mark. How do you take yourself out of your, how do you step out of your skin of, your bag of skin?
I'm a nature lover. I mean, I love being out of doors, you know, feeling the wind, feeling the coastal breeze, jumping in the ocean. But I also really love working with, hands-on with the material world. I love building things. I'm doing a lot of the building out at the Mountain Center with myself and my son. And it's sort of with these buildings, it's a cross between going to sculpture class and building something in the traditional sense with, you know, big rafters and post and beam style construction. I find that if every time I put myself closer to the natural world, I find out more about my own rhythms and my own, get more in touch with where I am, and you know, just slow down a little bit and connect.
That sounds wonderful. And I guess that really that's the best way. You know, one of the things that I always found as a younger person, on my path, as I, because I do teach metaphysics as well. And one of the things that I always thought about was how do I stay grounded? And in order for me to be effective, I needed to stay grounded. You know, it was very easy for me to go off in my spirit somehow and just, you know, escape. Did you ever, with Alan, your father, do you think that as he grew, his grounding became deeper?
The last word was his what became deeper?
His grounding, the experience that he had of grounding himself into this life.
I think so. I think that, you know, it's something that comes very naturally with age. And, I think that he became more comfortable with his course, his path, his decisions. And, you know, hopefully we all do. Hopefully we're, you know, that's what life's all about, you know, honing the edge and, you know, becoming more clear about what you're doing and feeling that you're working from the heart and having it all kind of come together.
War and all these things that don't fit into the life of your... You know, your father was a great, as I said earlier in the program, he was very involved with ecology. Were there any aspects of it that more interested him? And, you know, with this issue of global warming today that we're having, and, you know, the strange thing is that it's even a debate anymore, obviously. You know, let's go golfing in Washington, D.C. in January. There's no such thing as global warming.
Well, you know, I think all of this goes to what you were talking about a few minutes ago about going off into your own private world versus, you know, being part of the community. In Buddhism, it's called a pratekya or private Buddha versus a bodhisattva who recognizes mm-hmm. that you're not going to reach true enlightenment without everybody coming along for the ride. And I think that that's, you know, we're entering, you know, what's in the Buddhist culture is thought of as the age of compassion. And we're at a time when I think that that has to be put absolutely into practice, because it's true. We're not going to withdraw and retreat from the world and achieve anything as isolated from everybody else. I mean, maybe it's okay to take a retreat to renew your energies. I mean, that's something that everybody needs to do. But if you look at the ultimate plan and the sustaining of the planet, it's something that we really have to recognize we're going to do together, and that we have to be open to figuring out ways to work together. And it doesn't matter, you know, whether you're on a community level or a statewide level or an international level. I mean, the principles are the same. And it's fairly interesting because, you know, here I am, I'm working on trying to make a film on a man's life who, you know, immersed himself in this thing. And yet I run into the same kind of greed and conflicts and, you know, all of these things that come out, you know, in any kind of business dealings. And I said to myself, geez, you know, if we can't even make a film about a great philosopher, how are we gonna get beyond anything else in this world? But I think it doesn't matter what you're doing. I think that on every level you're going to come into these challenges, and that, you know, people are always trying to get ahead, and that creates a certain kind of conflict. And, you know, Gary Snyder put it beautifully in a conversation that he had with my father and Tim Leary and Allen Ginsberg on the Houseboat. It's called the Houseboat Summit Changes, the Houseboat Summit. It was a discussion about the Great Society. And it's this, you know, ultimately I think people have to make the decision that we're going to try and do with less and be happier with the things that are true wealth and not just, you know, riches that people have for status reasons, like, you know, expensive cars and that kind of stuff. And that by doing that, by some sort of a voluntary, I wouldn't call it poverty, but austerity, and a sane use of resources, we can start to bring this into balance for ourselves, but also for, you know, the world as a whole, because I think this country is leading leading the way by providing the absolute worst example of how to live on the planet. And, you know, maybe China's a little worse because they're polluting more flagrantly to get themselves up to our speed or our level as quickly as possible. But it's you know, we're at a point where we've got to look at that. I mean, we're living in a land where Native Americans lived, you know, in the same areas without destroying them for thousands and thousands of years, and we're destroying them in a few hundred. And at a certain point, you know, you look at what their values were, which is that they wouldn't take anything that they didn't need. They wouldn't take anything without asking its spirit permission. They wouldn't, you know, they in their system, the moons, the month names were named after various creatures that you didn't hunt in that season, because fish were spawning, because the deer were mating. I mean, and in a way, we've come a long way from that in our, with technology, so it's kind of hard to look back and be that, you know, close to the cycles of nature, but it's still all going on. And I think that that's the challenge that science faces now, and that's the challenge that we face, is, you know, becoming sensitive, becoming aware, and looking at these systems and looking at what it is they have to tell us, and learning soon enough not to destroy it. And, you know, it's a great challenge, but it's one that we're incredibly well equipped for if we'll only let our natural abilities and tools go to work.
Well, that's absolutely amazing. And, you know, the Maharishi actually believes that all of this can be accomplished within a few short weeks with a concentrated effort of oneness and unity across the planet. Your father being mystic and understanding the nature of this kind of effect, this global effect, do you also believe that this is a possibility?
That it be done within a few weeks?
That's what the Maharishi says.
Well, I hope that would be great. A few years would be a miracle. A few decades is probably more realistic. You know, the one thing you learned is the mind goes very quickly, but the body heals more slowly, and how much more the body of the Earth Mother. You know, we've done a lot of damage. And
yes, we have.
My dad used to say, you know, when you're changing direction, it's like a train, and it goes in a big circle to turn around and go the other direction, and if you stop it, all of a sudden it's going to fall off the track and make a big mess. And that's the kind of thing that we're trying to do, is we're trying to turn a train around. And so it takes a lot of little efforts and little energies and cooperation. I mean, that's the biggest thing. It takes cooperation.
Well, it absolutely does. And we try to do it before the actual train wreck happens.
We'll see. Yeah, that's the other thing. You know, the other theory of evolution is the catastrophic one, where, you know, these changes don't really happen gradually, but they happen as a result of big upsets in systems. So that's a really interesting theory. And I think that even from our speeded-up perspective, something that would be that type of catastrophe might look like a gradual change, because, we're so sped up in our perceptions these days that something that even a few years ago would be, you know, worthy of attention might be glossed over in a minute or two.
Thing that I would like to bring up is, prior to our show, we had our other show this evening. We had the director of Pacifica Radio, and your Greg Guma. Pacifica Radio, Cape Cafe in Berkeley. Your father had a long-running weekly radio program on that, and if I'm not mistaken, they still have. We were talking about all the archives and some of the historic archives they have, and that was one of them.
Yeah, he's actually been on the air in Los Angeles now for over 50 years running, and we were on until the early 90s. The year I was born, 1953, was his first year broadcast on Pacifica, and before it was taped, he would go over and go to the lecture booth and record the talk on a lacquer transcript the night before the show, like a big LP record. And but it's been on Pacifica for 50 years and on a lot of other stations around the country in Boulder, Tampa, New Jersey, Dallas. You know, it's been on and off. And now we have the podcast so that people can, you know, regardless of where they are, if they have that technology, they can tune in. We change the show twice a week. And, it's a
fascinating. Which is one of the things that I'd like you to elaborate, if you would. What kind of technology are you using as far as, like, producing into the site? Obviously, you just mentioned the podcast, online availability, his books. Are there any other aspects of the technological today that you're going to be using to help conglomerate your father's work?
Well, as a small publisher trying to keep over 100 titles in print, obviously advances like MP3 are huge. You know, instead of giving somebody 100 CDs, we can give them half a dozen. So that technology is something that we're actively embracing, and as more people, you know, get these players and you know, get up to speed with iTunes and these other MP3 interfaces, that's becoming a wonderful thing. And I enjoy it because the it's quick to jump around and review material when I'm looking for something, for instance. But the next thing that we're planning on is actually a searchable linked text database. So, for instance, if you're trying to remember where Alan Watts talked about how the human being was like a whirlpool, and that you see the whirlpool in the river and it looks like the same whirlpool, but it's not. It's different waters flowing through the whirlpool, so it's a whirlpooling. It's not a... Say this is an example that he uses. So you want to find the whirlpool story. So you'd be able to just type in whirlpool, and up would pop a couple of examples of it. And when you saw the one that you wanted, then you could just go to that one and hear it. So that
it's actually going to work similar to like Google search engines,
exactly.
And that kind of thing.
Yes, audio search engine. So that's something that we're actively working on going to integrate it with the website and probably with the Campbell website once we get it working. But
as a writer, for me, that's going to be phenomenal because I can't tell you how many times I've wished for something like that in a lot of these search engines, because you can come up with a very broad range of information, but generally you can't hone in on the one thing that you're looking for.
Yeah, and there's an art to searching even with the search engines we have now, but the nature of audio and visual is that it's extremely linear, which like text, but the roadblock here is getting materials transcribed. And so what we're going to do for starters, well, we've transcribed a lot of stuff for books, but we're going to take, say, the first 10% of a talk and get that transcribed, because he usually talks about, you know, what he's going to get into in the first 10 minutes. And it'll be fun. You'll be able to, you know, once we get a bunch of people loaded in, you'll be able to ask them all what they thought about God and compare the answers.
Well, you know, this has just been amazing, Mark. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Folks, this is Mark Watts. The Mountain Center is the place to be and to look for coming up in the future. Mark, thank you very much, and good luck with your projects. We will be keeping in touch and wanting to find out all that's going on there. Good night, everybody. This is the People Speak Radio Show, and we will be tomorrow, July 3rd, Jeremy Woodrum, co-founder of the U.S. Campaign for Burma, speak about Aung San Suu Kyi, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, held under house arrest in Burma. Thank you very much, everybody. Good night. And Mark, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Our honor.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the people by the relief fountain, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry.